Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we cover my beat, environment, health, food, policy, and science, and all of the things that are going on in our world that affect our well-being and the well-being of the Earth. We discuss this each week on Connect the Dots with experts, scientists, analysts, thought leaders, doctors, authors, filmmakers, and advocates. And since the time when we began the show, in like, I think 2010 or 11 it was, obviously there's more up and about and more activity and more information about rapid changes in all these areas and how they'll affect us. I'm so delighted to have with me on today's show a returning guest who's actually one of our longtime favorites, Bill Warren, a senior trade analyst at Friends of the Earth, works to protect the environment from the negative impact of international trade and investment agreements. We're talking about TPP, TTIP, and today we're going to be talking about the Trade and Services Agreement, TISA. You know, we've had a lot of coverage of TPP on this program from Bill and other experts. You can look into the Connect the Dots archives at any time to kind of get up to speed. But in the wake of recent WikiLeaks, of the documentation of what is intended with now this third agreement that's coming down the pike, it's really important to understand the implications of what is being decided behind closed doors and then put into global trade deals that will make a huge difference in our lives. Bill has been working on the policy discussion about trade and environmental issues for well over, well, really going on two decades or more. Prior to joining Friends of the Earth, he worked at the Forum on Democracy and Trade and other related organizations. He himself is also an attorney, graduate of Duke Law School. And because these trade agreements are in secret, very complex, really written for and by corporate lawyers, his interpretation of them has just been invaluable in seeding our understanding and advocacy. Welcome back to Connect the Dots, Bill Warren.
Well, thank you very much, Allison.
Now, today we're going to focus on the Trade and Services Agreement, TISA, and actually we would not know a whole lot about this were it not for a series of leaks by WikiLeaks, and there is a new one just this very month, and there have been past ones, and because these trade agreements, so-called trade agreements, are negotiated by multinational corporations and various industries behind closed doors in secrecy, we really have WikiLeaks and other whistleblowers internationally to thank for the fact that we know anything about what these deals are to begin with. And, you know, this week's revelations bring yet more to the table. Can you please first orient our listeners to what TISA is about? Which industries it regulates, what kinds of things it's going to be regulating and shaping in our world?
Well, it's a massive agreement, and it's being negotiated in the utmost secrecy in remote location in Switzerland. And it's quite broad in its coverage and its implications. Because and it's it covers services as opposed to goods. You know, goods would be autos or dairy product or widgets or something you could drop on your foot, so to speak. But in the modern world, services are by far the greater part of economic activity. Services amount for 80% of the U.S. economy and 75% of the European Union economy, and a majority of economic activity in almost every country. And this would cover a whole range of things, especially financial services, but also a large number of environmental services, and as well as some transport services, UPS, you know, that kind of thing.
What is an environmental service, just so we kind of can picture that clearly?
Yeah, well, for example, energy services, oil drilling, coal mining, those are activities. Think of Halliburton, you know, one of the two biggest oil services companies in the world. That's Dick Cheney's old firm, and beyond that, it would be related to privatization and deregulation of a variety of public services with environmental consequences. Think of sewage, water sanitation, solid waste, hazardous waste, nuclear radioactivity disposal and transportation, and so forth and so on. And energy services more generally, I mean, electricity utility services, natural gas distribution, oil and gas pipelines like Keystone XL, transportation policy, and it goes on and on and on. Agricultural services, agricultural issues services are very closely tied, and also the forestry sector. And I would especially emphasize water services, because this is an area where, you know, investors like T. Boone Pickens and large corporations like Suez have really been attempting to seize ownership of water resources and turn water into a commodity that could be traded in international commerce like oil and made available at their asking price. And TISA would clearly stand in the way of efforts to really honor the United Nations declaration that there is a human right to water. You know, it's not just another commodity.
Oh, my goodness gracious. So, I mean, from your accounting of this, it's almost like some of the most heinous provisions are actually coming in under this rubric of the TISA, TISA. You know, can you differentiate a little bit, like, how the TPP lays the groundwork and the TISA kind of builds out what has been laid down, or are they just kind of parallel and completely on, you know, each standing on their own? Or is there a way that, you know, one leads to the other and then this represents this further sector? I mean, your view of that.
Well, it covers many of the same things, and the deregulatory and privatization approach is similar. I mean, one reason why the TISA is so important is that it covers a greater part of the world and many more people. It's the parties to the TISA negotiations, the United States, the European Union, Japan, and 21 other countries, which in combination comprise two-thirds of the world economy.
Hmm.
And I think now there's only one thing that's, you know, that we worry about centrally in the TPP, and that's the investor-state dispute resolution, you know, the private suits. There's no similar provision for that in TISA, but rather it would be still very effectively enforced by traditional trade tribunals, which can levy retaliatory trade sanctions like higher tariffs or loss of intellectual property rights for the firms and countries that don't come into compliance. So it's a gigantic deal. It really covers more of the world than TPP or TTIP, the US-EU agreement. And we can only, we certainly hope. Now, there's some talk that they may shoehorn in the so-called ISDS or investor enforcement mechanism at the last minute. So I guess we can't totally be reassured on that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so let's first discuss. I mean, this is a huge thing, obviously. But in terms of what we can cover here in this program, let's first discuss what the financial services implications are. to this? You know, in other words, what will this do and what will change in the banking and financial services industry if TISA is put into force?
Well, basically, what it does is to put a pretty effective freeze on new regulations, and it begins the process of rolling back existing regulations. And of course, this is very important in the financial services area because there's a so-called ratchet provision in the TISA that says that once you deregulate, you can't re-regulate. And of course, that's exactly what happened after the financial crisis and the Great Recession, that that the United States and most other countries went back and looked again at their massive deregulation of financial services and made some modest but very important reforms to make sure that the riskiest kind of activities were not pursued in the future. So, again, this TISA deal is being driven by the Wall Street financial services firms working through a group called the Coalition for Services Industries primarily. So it's the highest priority for the people who are negotiating, like Mike Froman. And just in terms of examples, John McCain and Senator McCain and Senator Warren of Massachusetts have introduced what they call a new Glass-Steagall bill, which would establish firewalls between consumer banking and high-risk bank speculation, you know, the gambling with depositors' money. And that would be a new regulation that could very likely be imperiled. And the same thing, I think, would apply in the financial services area for too big to fail legislation. New regulations of, you know, really toxic financial products. And they want to move toward more self-regulation by the financial institutions themselves rather than by government oversight bodies. And then they would, again, want...
Let me just ask a question about that latter one. Because this also comes up in the WikiLeaks emails in talks that, you know, there's long been a call to release transcripts. And, you know, there are now some of the Goldman Sachs talks that were given in which Hillary Clinton also mentions, you know, allowing the banking industry to regulate itself. Does that look like? What is the difference between if they regulate themselves or if they're regulated by the government? For anyone that may be, I know it sounds like a kind of simple question, but, you know, what is the difference between asking or trusting or expecting, empowering them to do it, and it's being done, you know, by governments in terms of the outcome? Like, what will that look like?
Well, to use a cliche, the fox would be guarding the hen house.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is self-regulation is no substitute for government oversight. And there's an obvious conflict of interest because they're not going to change their business plans willingly, you know, on their own initiative. They plan to get involved in speculative activities and to gamble more with depositors' money. So it doesn't make any sense at all. It's a fig leaf.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they do that, that led to the 2008 crash. Is this a situation where, you know, that the stock market could again crash? You know, there could be a huge mortgage crisis. I mean, what form would allowing this kind of gambling that you're describing, you know, take? I mean, if that were allowed to proceed?
Well, Citibank and all the other ones who pushed hard are pushing hard for this TISA deal. You know, we're successful during the Clinton administration of, you know, substantially deregulating financial services, and that, you know, led to all those risky, toxic financial services products and the riverboat gambling. with depositors' money and so forth, and it could, and this promises to repeat that process.
Well, then it could repeat another crash. You know, what would happen then? I mean, how much would we, would the public again then be bailing out these banks because they're too big to fail? Or, you know, what, I mean, how many of these kinds of crashes and, you know, recoveries, you know, can we take? I mean, the last one was extremely depleting to the middle class. I mean, how, is it assumed that we could just infinitely rebound from this kind of thing? I mean, where is this taking us?
Well, I think it's right up to the precipice. I mean, this is really frightening stuff. I mean, they haven't learned anything. And we, the taxpayers, bail them out billions and billions of dollars because of the fear that it would cause another Great Depression, that, you know, it would be lead to the complete collapse of the financial system because it's, you know, it had become so centralized. And this is what's the old cliche, deja vu all over again. You know, it's it's really outrageous. And again, Mike Froman, the guy who's pushing this in Geneva, this TISA deal. You know, he used to work at Citi, and the city basically went under, and we all bailed out City and Mike Froman, and now they're at it again.
Mm-hmm. And what kinds of provisions on the financial side would be, you know, are they attempting to take down? What protections are they taking down, and you know, what are they? What will this deal actually do in that regard, for example?
Well, the one thing to understand that these agreements are procedural in character, meaning they set up legal mechanisms to deregulate and to privatize. And so the specific changes would be as a result of the operation of this new institutional framework and these new procedural and legal ways of fostering deregulation. But it's we know what they want to do. They want to go back to these high risk, high profit financial services products and strategies, and that's just insane, if you ask me. So it's too big to fail legislation, you know, close oversight of many financial services activities, you know, would be put at risk.
So they would, what about the foreign element? I mean, you know, whatever they would, in other words, new controls could not be put into place. The wrong people would be in oversight. What about foreign companies and entities coming in from abroad and having, you know, more rights over, you know, to despoil here, you know, or to, is there a heightened risk in that this is global and not merely national and domestic?
There's a giant risk, and it's called the City of London. Actually, by some measures, you know, that's the nickname for the London's equivalent of Wall Street. And by many measures, it's even larger than Wall Street. And also, the City of London has even more of a gambling culture than Wall Street. I mean, the British are notorious gamblers, and it's a wide open place, and clearly the City of London would, you know, those institutions like Barclays and so forth would want to be going after U.S. regulations. And then too, excuse me, get a drink of water here.
Yeah, this is
I was going to say that Citibank and Chase and all the Wall Street institutions have affiliates in the City of London and all around the world. So you could have U.S. institutions attacking U.S. regulations and attacking U.S. regulatory schemes, you know, from offshore.
Wow. So then we wouldn't even have, we would lose rights even because this is a global agreement and they could overrule anything that we do domestically. What about our corporations or U.S. corporations? Would we be playing some kind of predatory role internationally as a result of these agreements, either on the economic or on the environmental services side?
Oh, absolutely. And again, you've got the Wall Street institutions, other financial institutions, and don't forget Bank of America. I mean, the other big financial center is in Charlotte, North Carolina. And of course, Wells Fargo is in San Francisco. And so, yeah, they're all going to be conspiring.
And then what would they be actually doing? You know, what would they do to foreign countries or to, you know, other, or to, you know, Americans? I mean, what would they be doing abroad, for example, once they conspire? What would they be doing? Putting bad loans in and bankrupting countries? I mean, you know, like what kinds of, making it impossible for people to ever get mortgages? I mean, what kinds of, what would be the outcomes of these kinds of practices? Would there be a devaluation of currencies? I mean, you know, or an inflation? Like, what kinds of things would we be seeing on the ground?
Well, I think the threat would be recession or depression. Mm-hmm. Remember, the Great Depression was a result of financial services meltdown. You know, mm-hmm. We have the stock market crash in 1929. Mm-hmm. And so that's the scenario, because if you don't have a functioning financial system, then all economic activity is severely injured. And if you remember your history of the Great Depression, the economy almost ground to a halt, massive unemployment, bankruptcies right and left, farmers burning their crops because they couldn't sell them. And so we had a pretty bad experience in 2008, but we had a worse one during the 1930s, and I guess that's the worst-case scenario.
Mm-hmm. How rapidly, you know, what is the time frame for the TISA to be passed and to be enacted? You know, like how rapidly would this be happening? How soon would we begin feeling its effects? What kind of recourse would there be, you know, for our population if this were to be passed?
Well, we've just received very alarming news in the last couple of weeks or 10 days. And that is, I think, in part because of the hard pushback against the U.S.-European Union agreement and related agreement with Canada and Europe, and because of both presidential candidates being on a record opposed to the TPP, they're ramping up work on the TISA, and it's Mike Froman's goal to complete this deal in the first week of December. And now I don't know if he can pull it off, but he's not backing away. In the face of massive public and political opposition to these deals, he's trying to get it done by hook or by crook. And it especially worries me because I saw something just a day or two ago that seemed to indicate that Froman, who's a brilliant lawyer, is trying to devise a scheme whereby he wouldn't have to get congressional approval, that it would be done by administrative regulation. I don't know exactly how he pulls that off, but there's actually information that's leaked that indicates that Froman is looking for creative ways to draft the TISA so that it would could be implemented strictly by executive action and with no congressional or legislative concurrence. I don't know whether that's real or but it's clearly something that Froman's pursuing, and I am frightened to death by that.
Does that mean it would be enacted before the end of the current administration or in the next administration?
Well, technically speaking, as a matter of constitutional law, trade agreements are not enacted, but they have to have implementing legislation. In other words, the deal, you know, under the Constitution, the executive can make an agreement, but only Congress, can do the implementing legislation. So when we talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal coming to Congress in the lame duck session in November and December, that is the implementing legislation for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you can't, if you don't have implementing legislation, you don't have a deal. And apparently, Froman is pursuing this other route, in part because, unlike the TPP deal and so forth, there are no tariff or customs provisions in the TISA agreement. So he's exploring this, and I'm quite concerned.
So this, in effect, isn't a trade agreement at all. So in other words, it's not even a trade agreement. The other agreement only has 30% of its provisions pertaining to trade, but this has none. So what kind of agreement actually is it from a legal standpoint?
Well, I mean, I think it's more of an agreement, is it, from a common sense standpoint. I mean, it's mm-hmm. still a trade agreement in common sense terms because, it could unleash, a whole variety. Unleash a whole variety of new imports and exports of services. And again, that's anything you can't drop on your foot, so to speak. And it's pretty sweeping. But when you talk about trade in goods and tariff and customs issues, I mean, there's substantial law on that that's not already that had to be passed by Congress, and they would have to amend and revise all that pure trade stuff in order to implement the TPP. Froman thinks he sees a way around this, maybe, for the TISA deal. I'm guessing it might be a stretch, but it's something we want to pursue and find out if there's anything there. I'm afraid there might be.
Oh, dear. Let's shift gears and talk about the environmental services side of this. It sounds like, there's been a kind of various pivoting as to different positions of where the two presidential candidates stand in relation to fracking, to pipelines, to fossil fuel excavation, transport, and development. But when we talk about transport, one of the things that we know, for example, in the current Dakota Access Pipeline fight that's taking place with the Native American uprising in Standing Rock, is that the tar sands pipeline is coming from Canada, it would traverse the United States, and yet it will then go down to Texas, where the tar sands will be refined and shipped abroad. So, the U.S. energy market is not consuming this. This is destined for export. Given what you're talking about, it seems that the TISA agreement would have a lot to say about the export of fossil fuels, creating demands abroad, producing energy, fossil fuel energy abroad and shipping it, here and there. So it's really about the global trade and export and import of energy services, not just the local excavation or transport. And in effect, what we've seen is that, community by community, different communities are fighting the presence of these toxic, contaminating, climate-destroying fossil fuel forms of energy that come in through pipelines, et cetera. But actually, this is not just going through one community. It's going through many communities, and it's because of creating these markets abroad. Could you talk a little bit about what TISA will facilitate in terms of the international use of fossil fuels of various kinds?
Well, it would significantly ramp up global warming. It would be an immediate threat because services are at the heart of the energy industry. As you noted, oil drilling, coal mining, pipelines, port facilities, marine services, you know, the tankers that take the oil overseas. So it will have disaster. The TISA deal would have absolutely disastrous implications for the climate. It would accelerate global warming because we'd, the United States and Canada would be exporting tar sands oil and liquefied natural gas and coal out of coal ports to other parts of the world. And if you burn those fossil fuels, across the Atlantic or Pacific, the planet is cooked just the same as if they were burned in the United States.
So there's been this whole discussion of we're negotiating with India, we're negotiating with China, they're the big polluters, they're agreeing to, try to adhere to some elements of the Paris Agreement in order to, reduce fossil fuel use, et cetera. So, there are these big kind of public announcements and everyone is going, yay, hooray, India just signed a deal. But what does this mean in the context of the signing of the TISA agreement? Does it include these companies, countries that we ostensibly have just made a deal with? Does it supersede the national goals that, that we've long fought for and that, have been presented as solving the problem? I mean, what is the relationship between those two things?
Well, it means that the United States' commitment to the Paris Climate Accord is not worth, cost of the paper it was printed on. The Paris Climate Agreement and a variety of other international environmental agreements are only enforceable by moral suasion. But the TISA deal would be enforceable by retaliatory trade sanctions, like, let's say, a higher tariff on a higher tariff on the Japanese cars, for example, or by depriving, if Japan is non-compliant, depriving Japan of their intellectual property, like patents and copyrights on all their electronic products and so forth and so on. So the TISA deal will be enforceable. There's an outside chance it will even be enforced by investor state dispute resolution, which can be judgments of money damages running into the millions or billions of dollars. That remains to be seen. But the retaliatory trade sanctions by themselves are very powerful, and we could forget about all the climate targets that people agreed to in Paris.
So, so the mechanism there is that these the regulatory controls, for example, that we're trying to put in place to prevent tar sands extraction, export of liquefied natural gas, all of those kinds of things, the local protests, then in effect become a violation of international law and punishable if they were successful by sanctions of various kinds? Is that the implication here? In other words, how do they actually...
It's exactly what it is. It's not even implied. Mm-hmm. It's at the center of this agreement. It's in black and white, although it's written in legalese, which is a bit like reading ancient Assyrian script or something, but it's very clear that this will be the consequence, and it's horrifying. We're going to cook the planet if we pursue this TISA deal or any of the other ones.
And any attempt, any local attempt to do anything is essentially finished. So if one of the things we hear is when, you know, after the elections, we're hoping to push candidates, whoever is elected, in a more favorable direction. What mechanisms for pushing would still be operative in the context of the passage of the TISA agreement?
Well, I think that we have to hold elected officials and political candidates accountable. And we've done a pretty good job of that, thanks to Bernie Sanders, in terms of getting Hillary Clinton to see clearly that if she wants to be, if she wanted to be president, she had to go on record as opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The trouble is she has not gone on record as opposed to oppose the TISA. So there's the rub.
And also, you know, what people promise in a platform or on the campaign trail, and what, you know, they are ultimately going to do in public office. You know, if it isn't going through a legislative vote in the U.S. Congress, as you describe, you know, but it's going to be some kind of an executive administrative decision, then the sole pressure point for the public pushback on this would be the president. There would be no other, you know, right now, as we speak, as you mentioned, with the TPP deal coming in for a vote in the legislature in the lame duck session immediately following the election, you know, people are writing their congressmen, people are tallying which, you know, senators and which congressional representatives stand for or against the TPP. People are pressing their elected officials. But in this case, you know, it's basically up to the president. And, you know, apart from writing a petition or something, you know, without that other wing, or, you know, it seems like the push can't be that effective. I mean, one of the things about this is I was talking with someone about it, and they were like, well, this is unconstitutional. Why aren't people upset that it's unconstitutional? I think some people assume that nothing that was unconstitutional could be done, signed, or passed. You know, how is it? I mean, do you regard this as unconstitutional? And you know, if it were, what could people possibly do about that?
Well, I want to point out that this is just breaking news, that they're looking for a way to avoid going to Congress. And I'm very skeptical about whether they can really get away with that legally. You know, I'm certain there would be some litigation that would follow up on it. And I think it might be initiated by Congress. I'm sure, and beyond legal remedies, you know, like unconstitutionality and so forth, I think the Congress would not take kindly to having an end run on them implemented. And I think that the political pressure on the president would be overwhelming. So we actually might find a more receptive Congress, find it easier to communicate with members of the House and the Senate about this deal if it does, and this is speculative at this point, if it does bypass Congress. I think Congress would just react with overwhelming anger.
If it were put through Congress, then we basically are in the same kind of fight that we're now in, except with the question of whether the next president is opposed, neutral, or, you know, possibly pushing this. As you know, far as possible. Hillary Clinton is on record with her clean energy plan, which I did an article about in Truthdig recently, called Climate Should Trump Everything in this Election. But basically, she's on record stating that she believes that fracking could be done safely. She, in the past, you know, was selling fracking abroad. You know, I debunk the claims according, you know, that fracking could be done safely, looking into the scientific research and talking to various experts in this article. You know, what would, you know, if fracking were disseminated abroad, it seems like, you know, that would be a major problem for climate under the mistaken belief that, you know, it can be done safely. You know, what countries are you aware of where this kind of, where fracking exploitation, excavation, you know, the trade in fracked gas, like where, what would be the centers of activity for this?
Well, the big market will be Europe and Japan, because the Japanese have almost no natural resources that are exploitable for energy purposes. That's why they went so heavily and disastrously into nukes. And now they are very, very eager, especially for U.S. liquefied natural gas, which, you know, is a lot more dangerous to the climate than ordinary natural gas. And the same applies to Europe, because they are heavily dependent upon Russia for gas, and heavily dependent on Russia and the Middle East for fossil fuel, fossil fuels generally. And so it's been a consistent negotiating objective in all of these trade and investment deals for the European Union to, you know, really, you know, they want U.S. fossil fuel exports into Europe, because the only other sources are politically and economically dangerous, i.e., Russia and the Middle East. And the same way with Japan, now that they've, you know, had a bad experience with nukes, you know, they want especially the LNG.
So, I mean, according to that theory, if we were sweeping aside the considerations, you know, I mean, that sort of setup of the of how the world maps out for the for, you know, demands for this fuel, if we, you know, look at that and there were no climate considerations of any kind, there would appear to be tremendous economic benefit from this, and I'm sure that would be how it would be sold and presented. Who is the beneficiary of, you know, this economic boon of selling all of this stuff internationally to these thirsty for fossil fuel markets that you're describing?
Well, it would be the financial services firms that facilitate the investment in, you know, new drilling and new transport facilities. And, of course, it would be energy firms like Halliburton and all the big oil companies. As a technical matter of international law, most of what fossil fuel companies do is a service, and that's their value added, you know, beyond you know, the product of oil or gas itself. In fact,
so
you can't really separate goods and services as a practical matter when you talk about energy. And so that even though you're transporting a good, you know, you are transporting it, and that's a service.
What would be, if any, are there any provisions that would be helpful for renewable forms of energy thought through in these, you know, in the TISA? Is there anything that, you know, is that represented as a, you know, a market or a sector that, you know, would be enhanced by this and therefore going in the right direction, or is it more along the lines of what we've seen where, you know, with, I think it was the TPP, where, you know, solar companies were being kind of controlled and penalized by, as competitors, you know, by the, you know, the earlier trade deals. What would be the status here? Is there anything good in there for renewables, or anything that really kind of interferes with their use?
Well, I think it substantially undermines wind and solar and renewables and energy conservation measures, because those are all very local activities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't involve fossil fuels that have to be transported and traded commercially around the globe. So it would profoundly undermine the attempt to go primarily to renewables, and it would have a very profound impact on there, and in part because it might facilitate such a glut in fossil fuel production that it would keep the price of fossil fuels artificially and inappropriately low. So even as we're rapidly learning how to bring down the cost of producing through renewables, these deals would definitely make fossil fuels much more price competitive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a double whammy.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing is just the local nature of renewables, and the other is the way it would advantage the pricing of fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds, you know, we've talked so far about the financial services industry and the environmental effects services, and we're kind of got another 15 minutes of the show here. Is there any other services sector, you know, that's major that we haven't discussed? Or if not, we can move on to talking about, you know, who is the engine behind these this agreement?
Well, you know, there's just all kinds of services industries. I mean, when you talk about, you know, the privatization element of the trade and services agreement, this would include privatization of postal services.
Mm.
In other words, Federal Express and UPS and so forth are pushing hard for this TISA agreement because they want to put the post offices around the world out of business.
Mm.
And they want to be able to charge whatever the market will bear.
Mm-hmm.
For what is in many respects a public service.
Mm-hmm.
And also there are a variety of government services that have traditionally, been, you know, much more efficient than what the private sector can provide, and certainly more affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Since there are questions of economic equity and so forth. So again, the water services thing. I mean, it would be municipal water services and Suez and so forth. They would want to be able to charge whatever the market would, you know, take those over and privatize them and jack up prices regardless of people's capacity to pay. And the same way with municipal utilities. There are a lot of places in the United States that have public power. And if you go globally, it's even more common for governments to provide utility services of a whole wide range. And very concerning.
Hmm. You know, gosh, I mean, so here on the one hand, we have a situation that you're describing where, you know, fossil fuel energy, as it undermines the climate and the human habitat, is cheap. And yet municipal services like electricity, public transportation, gosh, I mean, hospitals, I mean, there's just a lot under that rubric, as well as water, is in short supply or prohibitively expensive. You know, I mean, this seems like it would result in, you know, I mean, mass crises, specifically the water thing. How, you know, what is supposed to happen there? Some people get water and some people don't get water? I mean, what is the idea there? Some people get contaminated, poisoned dregs of water, as we've seen from the Flint situation, you know, contaminated water. Like, and that's overruled and determined internationally? I mean, that is really horrific. What would ensue from something like this?
Well, you know, the privatization of water and other utilities has been pushed by big finance and multinational corporations for decades. And it's clear that they can't do what the public sector can do. You know, it's pay to play, and that is almost pay to live. I mean, if you don't have water, and if you for basic sanitation and drinking, and for, you know, small farmers to raise their crops, I mean, catastrophic consequences. And how about educational services? I mean, public schools generally do a lot better than for-profit schools. I mean, we've had these big scandals, haven't we, with these for-profit universities. You know, they're basically taking people's money and not educating them, so forth and so on. And so, it's very frightening.
And yet, you know, like, tell us a little bit more about, you know, Michael Froman and the Wall Streeters that are pushing this.
Well, as I said, the whole idea of the Trade and Services Agreement, it came from a man named Robert Vasteen, who was the past president of this powerful lobby group, the Coalition of Services Industry, which is led primarily by Wall Street and by Citibank in particular. And Mike Froman, the U.S. Trade Representative, as I mentioned before, was a Wall Street executive. You know, he worked to deregulate Wall Street as the top aide to Treasury Secretary Bob Rubin during the Clinton administration. And then he went to Citibank with Rubin, and they drove it into the ground. They engaged in, you know, speculative investments that blew up in their face, and we had to pay billions of dollars to bail out Citi and bail out Froman. And then he comes back in after raising a lot of money for President Obama in 2008, and it's actually one of Obama's oldest friends from Harvard Law. And it goes on the White House staff, and then as U.S. Trade Representative, and he's doing exactly what Wall Street wants by pursuing this Trade and Services Agreement. It's really their highest priority. They get more out of this than they do with the TPP, and they engage in some banditry in the TPP, if you can excuse my language. So it's very concerning. The prior Obama U.S. Trade Representative was Ron Kirk, who's best known as a former mayor of Dallas. But when he left his job as mayor, he went to Austin, Texas, where he lobbied for Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And before Ron Kirk was the U.S. Trade Representative, there was an acting U.S. Trade Representative by the name of Peter Allgeier. And Allgeier left USTR to do private consulting, where actually he was working with the tobacco companies to try to knock down anti-smoking regulations through trade suits and investment suits. And then he went to work as the president of the Coalition of Services Industries, carrying Citibank and Wall Street's water. He recently retired, and who replaced him? Another senior U.S. Trade Representative official, named Christine Bliss, She's again an insider who's been through the revolving door and representing Wall Street and their allies. And even the chair of this lobby group is a lobbyist who is a former senior U.S. Trade Representative staffer who cut these kinds of deals. And she went through the revolving door to go to where else? Citi. And then she moved then to UPS, and of course this whole Teasus deal started with Citibank, Wall Street, and their lobbying coalition, the Coalition of Service Industries, and you've got this revolving door between Wall Street and the top echelon of the U.S. Trade Representative's office, in other words, the people who cut the deals, and it's all self-serving, and this is why the deals are so bad.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. And yeah, that's really incredible. I mean, it's such corruption and collusion, and yet, you know, the majority of people still, I would say, don't know about it, although I think we also have done a good job of raising a lot more awareness than we used to have. What is your opinion about, like, that's why I'm really glad to be doing this show with you, to get more people aware that it's not just one thing and more is to be told and more is coming down the pike. Thank you so much for participating in this. How do you think we're doing? I mean, in terms of where we're headed with all of this?
Well, I'm cautiously optimistic. I think we've got a real shot at stopping the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the lame duck session of Congress, although, frankly, there's no reason to be over-optimistic. There's so many imponderables. If you were an odds maker, I would think you'd have to say 50-50, but we've got a lot of momentum, and we've had a few pickups of formerly pro-trade Democrats recently, and Denny Heck in particular from Washington State. So I'm optimistic, but everybody has to keep up the pressure. We have to really push hard. Mm-hmm. Now, this attempt to get a TISA deal done, especially by administrative action, may be Mike Froman's Hail Mary pass, It's going to be hard for him to pull this off, both legally and politically. Mm-hmm. But at this point, he doesn't have too much to lose because it looks like the TTIP deal is really, really in serious trouble in Europe. That's the US-EU agreement. And it's at best 50-50 whether the TPP will win. So, you know, this guy doesn't give up and he's smart as they come. So, his the rabbit he wants to pull out of the hat is this is trying to conclude this TISA deal in December, which is why we have to throw the public spotlight on what's happening. I think that if this were to get widely publicized, that it'd be, you know, we have a good shot at stopping it. But there's been almost no publicity or public attention to the TISA deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll try to change that, and we're changing it now, and you're party to it, listeners. Thank you so much, Bill Warren, for being with me today on Connect the Dots, you know, raising the flag of concern, awareness, and action on the TISA deal, thanks to your long following of it and recent WikiLeaks. I'll be following this up with an article on Truthdig as well. Please, people, go to Friends of the Earth, follow Bill's blogs. He blogs there regularly. William Warren, W-A-R-E-N, as well as, you know, follow both of us on Facebook and, you know, stay informed through Global Trade Watch, Friends of the Earth, Flush the TPP, and other activist groups. And we'll continue reporting it. Check into the archives here on Connect the Dots if you'd like to catch up on more information of previous programs with William Warren. Make sure to share with your friends and like us on iTunes. Thank you so much for joining me again in what I know is a very busy time for you, Bill. Very, very grateful. Thank you for your incredible analysis and just terrific work on all of this. And thanks to Friends of the Earth, too, for, you know, really tackling this as an environmental group, because a lot of the environmental groups, you know, get single issue focused and I've just always been really impressed with Friends of the Earth for reporting, and tracking everything related to the environment across the board. So great gratitude for that. And thank you, listeners, for being with us for another edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.